for everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On. I'm Red Sale.
I'm Robert Kirkwood.
And together, we're at the Wigtown Book Festival.
Hey! So, coming up in today's show, we've got a former Home Secretary,
a clergyman,
a bookshop owner,
a mountaineer,
someone performing in a chip shop, and maybe more, because we're recording this intro halfway through our time in Wigtown. That's all coming up in today's show. There certainly is more. I'm back in the studio after a hectic few days, and now the edit's complete, I can confirm that coming up in today's show, Kerry Hudson will be talking about Lowborn Down the Chipper. Sean Bithell on the sequel to Diary of a Bookseller, Confessions of a Bookseller. Sarah Jane Douglas on her memoir, Just Another Mountain. Bill Clegg, QC, takes us under the wig. We have a musical interlude from the Bookshop Band. Richard Fraser talks about travels with a stick. John Day tries to change your perception on pigeons with his book Homing. And we get some book recommendations from Natalie Haynes. And I should add that we spoke to more people than we can fit into this hour of Read On, so listen out for interviews with Melanie Reid, Professor Steve Jones, and founder of the Big Issue John Bird in future editions of Read On. But first, in today's show, let's turn to former Home Secretary Alan Johnson, who was in attendance with his book In My Life, a musical memoir. Red Sale asked him if he was enjoying the Wigtown Book Festival.
Fantastic. I came here, I think, 3 years ago, so I've been here once before, and was amazed. You know, I know now they call this Booktown. I can understand why. So it's a fantastic experience. And last time I was here, it poured with rain for the whole time. This time it's been blue skies and sunshine, so it's been wonderful.
And you've been busy today. You appeared with Lord Bird and Kerry Hudson this morning.
Kerry Hudson, yes.
Talking about inequality in the country.
Yes, and, you know, for a meeting at 10:30, it was well attended and was fascinating. You know, we never got around to the inequalities through disability, that, you know, another main strand of it. I mean, I was very proud my government introduced the inequalities bill, and it's amazing to think that before then, and that was what, 2003, I think the bill came in, the amount of discrimination that people, disabilities of all kinds, but including visual disabilities, who had such a lot to offer, such talent, that was just, in a sense, called marginalised. And I think that legislation was groundbreaking.
And access to work has helped so many of us back into work when actually we might otherwise have been consigned to life's scrap heap.
Exactly. Of course, my colleague in government was David Blunkett, who was born blind, and was, you know, the fact that David went on to become Home Secretary when he was told when he was at school that you will either be a piano tuner or a braille typist, and he went on to become Home Secretary, is just an amazing story.
Now, you were talking about literacy being your path out of poverty, but clearly with your memoir, music has played just a bigger part as literacy.
I'd say books were the main part, because you know, I'm autodidactic, I suppose. You know, I left school at 15, but reading, getting words into kids' heads at a young age, such an important part of their education, that early intervention. And access to music as well, of course. But reading leads on to so many other things. So illiteracy was a big problem in this country, and as well as innumeracy. So proper education for kids in the basic skills, I think, was a crucial part of the revolution in education over the last 20 years.
Well, I was certainly struck by the image of the 16-year-old Alan Johnson and his bandmates scribbling down Bob Dylan lyrics. It's a form of literacy itself.
Because they didn't put the lyrics on the album. Yeah. It wasn't until Sgt. Pepper's when the Beatles did it, and then everybody does it, yeah.
You were famously in Tony Blair's cabinet. Would you have had him in your band?
No, he was terrible, Tony. He had a Fender Telecaster, which is a very good guitar, but I don't think he was up to scratch. One of my senior civil servants at DWP, when I first got into the cabinet, was in Ugly Rumours, which was the band that Tony was in, and he thought it was rubbish, and he was in it, so you know, I'm afraid... Tony never... He loves the Foo Fighters and used to play a few licks from the Foo Fighters, but he never... he never purported to be a proper rock and roll star, unlike me, of course.
Do you enjoy narrating your own audiobooks?
Yes. I've done my own, all four of them, I've done my own audiobooks, and I can't understand why writers don't want to read them themselves. Maybe they haven't got the time, because it's 3 days in a recording studio.
And with everything going on in Westminster at the moment, would you secretly like to be back there?
No, I'm very happy being a writer now. So fiction now is my next big challenge, and I've got a thriller that will probably be out in 2021, but I'm enjoying doing that.
The enormous wireless hired from Radio Rentals would be tuned to the BBC Light programme, as I suspect was almost every other radio in the country. There was no alternative to the BBC in 1957. Commercial radio was years away, and while the names of overseas stations, such as Luxembourg and Hilversum, were optimistically printed onto some tuning dials, getting any reception through the maze of atmospheric noise was difficult. Our radio didn't offer even the remote hope of such exotic alternatives. The Radio Rentals engineer had installed it high up, its wires running into a brown Bakelite casing fixed to the kitchen doorframe at eye level. This provided us with a switch and three numbers. The choice was 1 for the Light programme, 2 for the Home Service, which broadcast mainly news and current affairs, and 3 for the classical music offered by the third programme.
Alan Johnson reading from his book In My Life, a Musical Memoir. The three previous volumes, This Boy, Please Mr. Postman, and The Long and Winding Road, are available from RNIB Talking Books.
You're listening to a Wigtown Book Festival special edition of Read On. And one of this year's Reader's Talks came from a rather unusual place. Kerry Hudson presented a talk based on her book Lowborn from The Chip Van.
So Lowborn is, it's kind of billed as a memoir, so it covers the first 16 years of my life, which took place at really the sort of quite extreme end of working class poverty. And then the contemporary sort of passages are where I decided to go back to those towns to find out whether poverty has changed in those towns, and if it hasn't, why has it not changed for kids 20 or 30 years later?
Your first book, whose title I'm going to mess up, so you say it.
Tony Hogan bought me an ice cream float before he stole my ma. Yeah.
Your first book's a fictional account of that?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's a communal garden sort of semi-autobiographic first novel, I think. Anyone who says that theirs isn't is maybe fibbing. But it was a way of exploring sort of the world I came from, which I knew was like full of humour and heart and drama and, you know, really, really high stakes. And so I always knew that I wanted to write about that world, because to me it's such a natural sort of environment to set a novel in.
Now, you say in Lowborn that you saw something and you ran towards it. You ran and didn't look back. What was it you were running to?
Anything but where I was. I mean, I think I write about this a lot in Lowborn. I kind of benefited from the fact that we moved around so much that we weren't really ingrained in the estates that we grew up in. If we'd stayed in Aberdeen, where all of our family were, I don't know whether I would have left, but we didn't really have that sort of massive connection. And I was a weird, queer, artsy kid, and I was never going to be able to make my future in Great Yarmouth, which is where I spent my teens. So I knew I had to go somewhere. I just didn't know where I was running to in the end.
And why the decision to not do a typical book event, but to do it in a strip shop?
It's really, I'm looking at trying to experiment with ways that we can get stories to people in different ways. People who are not going to come to a literary event for whatever reason, to try and get stories in a more sort of visceral and accessible way out to the public. And so having them in a chip shop feels like a very easy way to engage with what is a really quite a difficult sort of story, which is you sit down, you have your chips, and you just watch someone telling you a story for 25 minutes. Not too long, but long enough for them to see some of their community and their lives, I hope, reflected in those stories.
And along with the chip shop, you did a panel with Alan Johnson and Joan Bird. And it's remarkable how similar your stories were, and it was literacy that gave you a way out.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was quite interesting is that we kept referring to our ages. They're a little bit older than I am, not to be impolite. So, I mean, how absolutely terrible that I experienced much of what they experienced 20 years earlier, and that then I returned to my communities, and there are still kids experiencing that. But one of our greatest saving graces, as you say, was access to libraries or good English teachers, access to words and books that showed us other lives and other experiences we might have. And so that's why it feels even more important to campaign and campaign and campaign to make sure that kids can have access to books either through school libraries or through literary schemes.
Is that what you found when you returned to the places that you once lived?
Overwhelmingly, yeah. Partly because of austerity measures. I mean, I think if I'd written this book 10 years ago, I might have gone back and found them struggling, but not as hard up as they were. But the place I went back to had been really, really kind of smashed to pieces by sanctions. Benefit sanctions were a big thing. The erosion of social housing stock, which meant it was either very bad social housing or that they were at the mercy of private landlords where they could do anything and charge anything. And also that often industries that had been ripped out at the heart of those communities, so mining, for instance, in Northumbria, nobody had ever replaced them with anything. They hadn't really looked at serious regeneration schemes for those towns.
Now, we're on RNIB Connect Radio, and you yourself narrated the audio versions. How was that?
It was fine for me. For the poor sound engineer who knew me much better after 5 days, it was less good, I'll be honest. I thought it was good. You know, you just turn up and you read your book and I wrote the words, it'll be fine. And I find it extremely challenging, but I'm so happy with how it came out because it's my story. And so having people listen to me tell them what's a very personal, intimate story feels like the best possible way that people can get it, I think.
Shall we start with a happy ending? I made it. I rose. I escaped poverty. I escaped bad food because that's all you can afford. I escaped threadbare clothes and too tight shoes. I escaped drinking or drugging myself into oblivion because. I probably escaped early mortality rates and preventable diseases. We'll see. I escaped obesity. I escaped the higher rate of domestic abuse. I escaped sink estates, burnt-out houses and ice cream vans selling drugs at the school gates. I escaped Jeremy Kyle in a shiny suit telling me my sort was scum. I escaped casual, grim violence fueled by frustration and special brew. I escaped hopelessness.
Kerry Hudson reading from Lowborn, which, along with Tony Hogan bought me an ice cream float before he stole my ma, and Thirst are available commercially now. Lloyds Bank, Halifax and Bank of Scotland are teaming up with the Be My Eyes app to pioneer a new way to assist blind and partially sighted people. If you bank with Lloyds, Halifax or Bank of Scotland, you can access a member of bank staff through the app who can support you with everyday tasks such as banking queries, navigation around the website and much more. Using the app through the specialised help function, your mobile camera will link you through live video with banking staff, allowing a more direct way to ask questions about your day-to-day banking needs. Just download the Be My Eyes app for Apple or Android and search for the banking service within specialised help. Please keep yourself safe by never revealing confidential information through this service. You will never be asked for your PIN number or confidential information during any of these calls. You're listening to Read On, recorded live at the Wigtown Book Festival. Now, the beating heart of the book festival is The Bookshop, run by Sean Bithell. And his best-selling Diary of a Bookseller has got a sequel, In Confessions of a Bookseller. He spoke to Red Sail.
It's a bit of a misnomer. There's not much confessional about it. It's just another diary.
And the audiobook version is out too, narrated by Peter Kenny, who's a different narrator from the first one.
I wasn't involved in the decision-making in that process, but it's interesting. I think some people got used to the first voice, but a lot of people prefer Peter Kenny. I think they're both extremely good, so they're professionals. So I don't mind. My audiobook publisher chose the narrator. It's more of the same, your frustration with customers who try and beat you down on the marked up price. You've got a rather good line to combat that with now, haven't you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. If anyone tries to haggle me now, I'm going to quote Mr. Pumphreston in The Intimate Thoughts of John Baxter Bookseller, whose standard reply is, "This is not an Arabian bazaar."
And the John Baxter book, you've got passages from the book throughout Confessions.
Yes, in the same way that I quoted George Orwell's Bookshop Memories at the start of each month in the first diary, I quote from John Baxter Bookseller in the second one, at the start of each chapter.
Now, I know you like to come across as a curmudgeonly man, but actually that you told a lovely story about a pair of signed Aubrey Beardsley books, which I think shows your softer side. Could you just share that with the Read On listeners?
No, I sold a set of Aubrey Beardsley books to a customer who offered me £800 for them before I'd had a chance to do any research and see what they were actually worth. And he said, "Oh yeah, that's all they're worth." And then I met him at a book festival in Carlisle. He said, "Oh, I got 19,000 for those Aubrey Beardsleys you sold me," and didn't offer me a penny.
You said that had you found out how much more they were worth, that you would have gone back to the person and offered him more.
Absolutely. If it's on that kind of scale, then you know, it's almost theft if you don't. I think it's, you know, it's morally obliged really to make sure that you're fair with people, although there's always that caveat emptor and caveat vendor. I think there's a little bit of human decency. Would it have, I mean, if that had been me, I would have gone back and given that the guy I bought them off probably 60 or 70% of what I sold them for. I mean, I don't do it if I buy a book for £5 and sell it for 20, but, you know, if you're talking hundreds to thousands, then I think it's incumbent upon you to do the right thing.
What is the most valuable book that you have sold in the bookshop?
Over the years, I sold a book called Audubon's Birds of America so it went into an auction. I didn't actually own it. I was handling it on behalf of a customer, and it sold for £37,500. I sold £400 of that. That was it.
Has anybody had the gall to come in and offer you a copy of Diary of a Bookseller secondhand?
Yes. About 3 months ago, a woman came in with a box of books to sell, and in it was a paperback copy of Diary of a Bookseller, which I happily bought. And that's the first one. I imagine there'll be a few more. Yeah, it was an interesting experience.
How has life changed for you now that you're not only a bookseller, but a bestseller?
I have no time, absolutely no time to myself. Partly that's because I've got married and had a daughter as well. But yeah, because I have to go and do talks, I have to write. I've got another book in the pipeline. Everything's just got busier and I don't have any time. So I'm not any better off. I don't work any less hard. I don't think being a bestseller, being on the best Sunday Times bestseller list, can necessarily means you're going to make a lot of money, because it certainly hasn't for me so far. But it's certainly nice to be, like, to receive that kind of accolade and to be able to say I'm a bestseller. My publisher's loving it. They're slapping Sunday Times bestseller on everything now, so we'll see.
And Diary of a Bookseller has been optioned for the film. Who would you love to play you?
I don't know any actors. I don't really watch television, and I'm appalling when it comes to popular culture, so anybody. You could do it, Red.
And can we expect Volume 3 next year?
I think so. That's my agent over there with whom I'm about to discuss how we proceed next. So yes, next year, do you think, Jenny, for the third volume, if I can get it done?
Paperback next year, and then, yes, let's hope 2021.
For the third volume.
Yeah.
Right, cool.
Sneak preview on the title?
I have no idea. I haven't even thought
Testament
about it.
Testament of a
bookseller. Testament, yeah. Let's jump on bandwagons.
Well, Sean Biffle, thank you so much for appearing on the show again, and I look forward to talking to you this time next year.
It's been my pleasure, as always, Red, and I look forward to it too. Thank you.
Saturday, 3rd of January. Online orders, 10. Orders found, 10. Back to normal hours after a week of opening at 10 a.m. rather than the usual 9 a.m. A grey day, but at least the wind and rain have gone. The end of the festive period is always marked by a sharp fall in the number of customers. But today, that feeling of emptiness in the shop was ameliorated by the fact that the first customer was Jeff Mead. Jeff is the Church of Scotland minister for the nearby parish of Kirkinner, and his public persona is probably best summed up by my friend Finn, who once told me that Jeff is more comfortable doing funerals than weddings. This, though, belies his true character, which is mischievous, witty, and remarkably intelligent, with a formal theological education. He's close to retirement and is a large, imposing man. Shortly after I bought the shop, back in 2001, he came in for a browse. I'd bought a life-size skeleton which I'd planned to suspend from the ceiling. I have no idea why, but it's still there, playing a violin, and which I'd temporarily placed sitting in one of the armchairs by the fire with a copy of Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion in its bony fingers. I heard a howl of laughter from the depths of the shop, and shortly afterwards, Jeff appeared and announced, "That's how I want to be found when my time comes."
Peter Kenny reading from Sean Bithell's Confessions of a Bookseller, which, along with the Diary of a Bookseller, is available in print and audio wherever you buy your books. You're listening to Read On, recorded live at the Wigtown Book Festival. Coming up soon, the Bookshop Band, under a QC's wig, and some pigeons. But first, Sarah Jane Douglas was at Wigtown talking about her book Just Another Mountain. In 1997, Sarah lost her mother to cancer. Distraught, she took solace in the mountains, tackling all of Scotland's Munros, and finally the Himalayan peak that had killed the man who would have been her stepfather. So, when she herself was diagnosed with cancer, she treated it as just another mountain. She spoke to Red Sail.
You grew up in the Highlands, and you were saying that your mum introduced you to walking and mountaineering at quite an early age.
Yes, I was about 4 or 5 years old. Well, we had walked, obviously, before that. I would just tail her along the beach, but there was a small hill at the front of our family home, and she used to take me up that, and I loved it because it was just myself and her, and climbing up one of the various threads of sandy trail, we reached the top of the hill, and it was just myself and her, the wind in our hair, and the world at our feet, and I just felt as free as a bird.
And she was a single mum, and that was, I suppose, the time that you felt closest to her, when it was just you and she and the natural beauty of the area around Inverness.
Yes. I mean, I was always looking for ways to be closer to my mum. I was like her little shadow. And so when we walked together, that was our special time together, and that was, you know, how we bonded.
After she died, you were saying that you had some pretty dark times, but going out and climbing the Munros was your way of dealing with the grief and reconnecting with life.
That's right. You know, when you're on a mountain, you're so preoccupied with route finding or just looking at the beauty of the landscape around you, or you're aware of weather changes, you're distracted from problems that otherwise overshadow daily life. You know, these issues seem to melt away. And for me, being on top of a mountain, you know, I become a much better version of my own self. You know, I'm competent, I'm in control, I know what I'm doing, and I like that because I'm not like that in my real life.
And where did that drive come from?
Oh, a little bit of everything, I think, because obviously mum was who introduced me to walking, and she was the first person to take me up to the top of a hill. It was something we had done together. Going out makes me feel reconnected to her, even though she can't be with me anymore.
Later you found a journal that was kept by the man who would have become your stepfather had he not died in the Himalayas on Nupsi, and that led you on a kind of pilgrimage to climb the mountain that claimed his life.
Yes, so reading his journal revealed the true depths of my own mother's character, and I actually came to accept her life as well as her death. And Mum and Jerry were meant to marry in June 1975, but 6 weeks before their marriage, he fell to his death from the summit couloir of Mount Nupsi, which is a part of the Everest chain. And it was at that point of, you know, reading about Mum and his love for her. And although they couldn't be together in life, I thought I would reunite them in their death. And so I decided to take Mum's ashes out to Nepal and take her to find Jerry and scatter her ashes there to be with him.
Thanks to Sarah Jane Douglas. Just Another Mountain is available in print and ebook now.
You're listening to Read On, recorded live at the Wigtown Book Festival. But Robert and I weren't the only people from RNIB at the festival. Here's Chair of RNIB Scotland, Sandra Wilson.
The Wigtown Festival is just mecca to ardent readers. People who are here are passionate about books, passionate about reading, and it seems a great way to promote our talking book library. It's been, well, people are just beginning to come and go, but we've had a fair number of people round the stall, finding out what we do and taking away our literature and helping to support talking books in the time-honoured way.
And how much does it cost to sponsor a talking book?
It costs $1,500 for a child's book and $2,500 for an adult book. And how RNIB goes about its fundraising for talking books is if you were, you know, you're having a pint with somebody and you say, how about raising $2,500 to sponsor a talking book? They're quite likely to say, oh, I don't think I could do that, it's an awful lot of money. But if 10 people each say, well, look, we'll get together with friends and contribute 250, you've got your book in no time. So we try to do community talking books where members of a community get together and do various things. We have quizzes, we have bake sales, we have sponsored walks, fun runs, you name it. People come up with really interesting ideas, and that way there is the money for the talking books. And when the book is being sponsored and being produced, the dedication comes from the community that sponsored the book. So everybody feels involved and a part of this book.
Yeah, that's what I like about it. It's not going into a bottomless pit. You actually get something at the end of your fundraising effort, and your name's on that forever.
And people see where their money is going, and they see the value of it. Because audiobooks now are popular. People listen in the car. So it's not that if you're a teenager, you're not different because you're getting your books from the talking book library. You're reading what everybody else is reading at the same time.
Next on Read On, time for some music. Now, along with authors at this year's Wigtown Book Festival were some musicians. Beth and Ben Please are the Bookshop Band, and I met them at an evening event called A Feast for the Ears.
We are the foxes working for you. Bring out your boxes before you settle down. We are the foxes working for
Hello,
you.
Hello, I'm Beth Please.
I'm Ben Please. The Bookshop Band started as a... Well, we weren't the Bookshop Band, we were just Ben and Beth, and we actually had a third member, Poppy, in Bath, and we started as a collaboration with between us three songwriters and a bookshop in Bath called Mr. B's Emporium of Reading Delights. Their big thing is fiction and new fiction. They have a wonderful series of curated author events, and they wanted to kind of, I guess, spice them up from being just the author comes in, reads a bit, signs a few books, to creating a themed event with sort of themed food and talking about other books in the theme, and just trying to broaden it out. And as part of that, they wanted to do some music, and so we came in as songwriters to basically as a songwriting challenge for us to write some songs for those events. We'd read the book and inspired by the book, to play back to the author in this small room above this bookshop, and that's how it started, and that's how it continues, really.
Running wings round covers more ground, with foxes in a big rush, jumping on a night bus. City lights glow like a light show, keeping strange hours, smelling all the flowers.
How do you avoid spoiling a book?
I think our responses to these books are very much just our response. So they're not necessarily retellings of the story. There might be slight hints just because they've got in there, but I think I like to think we don't give away too much, and we like to give an essence of the book perhaps rather than a retelling of the book. We never know how the songs are going to come out, but we don't want to spoil it for people.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times, writing a song about first lines.
We were asked by the Verve programme on Radio 3 for their first show of the year in January a few years ago. They were like, it was, the theme was beginnings, and so they asked us to try and write a song using the beginnings of books. This was a song we had to play live on the radio, and we didn't write it until the last possible moment. And I kind of woke up in a cold sweat thinking, actually, this is going to be a really difficult thing to do, because all these wonderful first lines of books are not going to rhyme with each other or fit into a neat rhythmic structure. So we printed out every first line we could find and got sellotape and bits of string and actually had a lot of fun putting it together.
One of my favourites, which I wasn't expecting to be a favourite, was The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell. And I think before I became a member of the Bookshop Band, I didn't even think that I particularly liked fiction, which is a ridiculous thing to say, but I was in my head, it was, yeah, I like non-fiction. And then we had to read these books, and they were all brilliant books. You know, they were curated by the bookshop. We met the authors, and we really got into that world of fiction. And again, I was like, well, I'm not really into fantasy. And then read this book, The Bone Clocks, and I just think the different worlds and the different characters and the way he told it from each character's point of view and switched and got rhythm into it. It was almost poetic, a lot of it. And so, yeah, appealed to my kind of musical sense, I think.
Recently, I've particularly enjoyed Underland, so going into non-fiction, so normally we do fiction just because that's Mr. B's sort of particular passion, but we were asked to write for the launch of Robert McFarlane's Underland, and that's him journeying into underground places around the world, from like caverns and underneath cities to glaciers to caves or underground rivers, and just following his journey into sort of some quite terrifying places and feeling his terror but also the wonder and beauty. It was a journey into somewhere where I'd be too cautious to be as adventurous as he was. And so that was a real treat, that was a real reading treat, to be carried into these places. The song that came out of that, yeah, it takes me back to those places, so I really enjoy that.
Few events. We're doing a breakfast show every morning at 9:30, and basically it's us chatting to authors who we may have met the night before, and we've got them to come along to our breakfast show to talk about what they're going to be doing at the festival. So it's quite an informal thing with croissants and coffee and tea, and just a relaxed setting with us asking fairly ignorant questions about their books, but interspersing with some music. And then we have an event with Ken
Cockburn,
who is a wildlife bird poet, and we're going to be singing some songs inspired by birds. We've done a few songs about snow geese, so there'll be some snow geese songs. And then we're doing an event with Jackie Morris, who's an artist who actually worked with Robert McFarlane on The Lost Words, which is a brilliant book, illustrated kind of poems about words that were taken out of the Oxford Junior Dictionary, and they were words like acorn and bluebell and conquer. So that book's a brilliant book. But she's actually coming, Jackie Morris is coming to talk about her new book, which is called House Without Windows. And the book is, it's not her own story, but she's illustrated it and she's written an introduction forward to it. And it's by Barbara Fawcett Newell, or the other way around, but she was a 12-year-old girl who wrote this book in 1927, or first got published in 1927, and then didn't really get republished, hasn't been republished recently at all. And so Jackie Morris has brought this child's story back into life, and we're going to be writing a song inspired. We started writing a song inspired by that to play next weekend.
Isn't 9:30 awfully early for a book festival?
Mm. It's awfully early for a musician, I think. I think Adrian, the festival director, had it in his head that it'd be a good way to get free croissants to a number of people, which I think draws the authors in for sure. But I don't think any musician should have to sing before 11 o'clock in the morning, so it's... unfortunately, it's gone down rather well, and we've been asked to do it again.
Yes, but we do have a 2-year-old, so we're often up quite early anyway. So
yeah, we've been up for 12 hours before that.
Now, if anyone wants to find out more, where can they go?
Well, we have a website, which is thebookshopband.co.uk, and that's generally got a fairly up-to-date listings of where we're playing. We're actually got a lot of touring coming up in October and November, so we're going all over the country. We're supporting the Unthanks for a bit, so we'll be playing lots of nice music venues, which will be a change for us. And we also have a Twitter, The Bookshop Band, and Facebook, and all the usual social media. But we'd much rather they came and find us at a gig. That would be fun.
Thanks again to The Bookshop Band. Now, quick quiz, can you identify this TV theme tune? Did you get it? It's Perry Mason, cited by William Clegg QC as one of the reasons why he started a career in the law. Leading murder case lawyer Bill Clegg revisits his most intriguing trials, from the acquittal of Colin Stagg and the shooting of Jill Dando to some Nazi war crimes. And he himself narrates the audio version of Under the Wig.
How can I defend someone who I know is guilty? It's the question I'm asked most often. It is really a velvet glove on some finger pointing. How can I, a decent man, speak up for a rapist or murderer? How can I put my professional skills and intellect at the disposal of someone who has committed such a terrible crime? All advocates are asked this question, perhaps me more than most, because of the nature of my career. I have defended more than 100 people accused of murder, probably more than any other lawyer practicing in England. The first thing to say is that in English law, to defend someone who I know in the strict sense of the word is guilty is not allowed. If the client tells me they are guilty, I must not tell a court they are innocent. For crimes such as fraud or drugs, a client may freely acknowledge what they have done and plead guilty, perhaps after I have pointed out the strength of the case against them and told them of the reduced sentence that greets a guilty plea. This happens often. I don't varnish the facts. Murder, though, is different. Murder is killing someone with the intention of causing them serious harm or death, and a sentence of life imprisonment automatically follows for anyone who pleads guilty or is convicted by a jury. The most that is given is a minor reduction in the tariff, the minimum jail term that must be served before parole is considered, which is little incentive to admit guilt. So a client will not usually tell me they have committed murder.
The book is not designed to be a standard autobiography. Every alternate chapter explains to the layman what it's like to become a barrister, how we prepare cases, how we do our work and run our practices, how we become a QC, how we become a judge, and things like that. And the intervening chapters describe a case that I've been involved in.
Now, you've been in the job for 47 years. Have you seen many changes in the way of diversity in the workplace?
There's been a huge change in the workplace with diversity. When I started there were comparatively few women judges, comparatively few women barristers. That has now changed, and all for the better. The majority of people coming into the profession now, in fact, are women, just over 50%, which is encouraging. And there's also been ethnic diversity as well. Chambers tend to be much more balanced between the sexes and between different racial backgrounds, which is all to the good.
I know you've had various different roles, but you say you're a natural defender. What makes you a natural defender?
I don't know. I think I'm better at being a defender than I am a prosecutor. I don't quite know why. I suppose it's a sort of vague feeling of sort of helping the underdog. And most of the television drama that first interested me in the law is based on defence lawyers. So that's probably where it comes from.
Yeah, you mentioned Perry Mason.
Yes, indeed. That was my introduction to the law. He never lost a case.
Now, the audio version of the book is read by yourself. How was that process?
I found it very interesting. It took two long days and in a recording studio where they were tremendously sensitive microphones, so that if your stomach rumbled, they would stop the recording and give you a bit of banana to eat to settle the tummy and go on. And I found it quite hard work, but very interesting.
That audio version has, of course, made the book accessible to people who may have a print disability or can't see. Is that important to you?
Yes, I think audiobooks now are really, really valuable facility for people who have difficulty in reading. My own mum has huge difficulty now with the printed page, and she listens to a lot of audio books, and there are many like her.
Thanks again to Bill Clegg, QC. Still to come in today's Read On, recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival, are some pigeons and the books of Natalie Haynes' life. But first, let's go on a pilgrimage.
My name is Richard Fraser, and I've just published a book called Travels with a Stick, which is basically, partly at least, the story of a walk that I did from Le Puy-en-Velay in France to Santiago de Compostela. In other words, what often people call the Camino de Santiago, or the Chemin de Saint-Jacques, if you're in the French side. And it's partly it's the story of my walk, but partly it's also a bit of a reflection on 30 years of being a minister in the Church of Scotland and recognising that that Christianity, I think, for the best part of its entire life of 2,000 years, does a huge amount to fail ordinary people. I found that in opening myself to strangers in their kindness, I learned a lot of things. For example, right at the beginning of my walk, I set off a wee bit like a greyhound out of a trap, and I was very competitive. I got incredibly wet on the first day of my walk. It was absolutely torrential rain. I got really wet, and by 3 days in, I'd walked nearly 100 kilometres, and I had terrible, terrible blisters. And then I met a man who was called Jacques, who ministered to my feet. And he saw the state that I was in, and he offered to help, and he helped me. And I realised that after 30 years of being a minister, that was incredibly that I'd been incredibly self-reliant throughout my time, I discovered a bit about my own vulnerability. And it was a kind of lesson in life. And allowing yourself to be helped by a stranger. I said to the guy the next day, you know, I came on the Chemin de Saint-Jacques, but I didn't expect to meet Saint-Jacques. And so there was that kind of thing. And then, you know, just so many people that I met on the way just taught me so much, you know. And there was kindness. It felt like people were angels, like Jacques was a kind of angel on the way. But also, you know, I met people who said, well, you know, I'm not interested in religion anymore, but I'm deeply spiritual. And so many of the people that I met on the way, sometimes people doing this pilgrimage walk, not because they're religious, not because they were particularly doing anything that might be described as a kind of religious journey, found themselves being changed by the experience of walking, the experience of being immersed in a landscape, and by the experience of meeting people. And what people often say is that you set off to do the Camino, but in fact the Camino does you. Whatever faith is, whatever spirituality is, it is a journey. And there are going to be places where people are going through dark places, where people are full of questions, where people are not, you know, it's like being in a kind of desert area or in a lush area. Life is like that, you know, it's not. And I sometimes think that our idea that Christianity should be fixed in terms of its dogma, fixed in terms of its buildings, is complete nonsense. And in fact, the early first century church, people called it the people of the way. That's what Christians were called. It was people on a journey. And even in the scriptures, even in the Bible, you know, there are stories of people going on journeys and discovering extraordinary things just by traveling.
Thanks again to Richard Fraser. Travels with a Stick is available in print and ebook now.
In a previous edition of Read On, author Elif Shafak recommended Homing by John Day as one of the books of her life. And guess who Robert ran into at the Wigtown Book Festival?
So Homing is a book about my experiences as an amateur pigeon racer, pigeon fancier, and my I have a long-standing interest in pigeons. And a few years ago, I moved house in London, just a few miles from where I'd grown up, but in the process felt very unhomed or felt strangely, you know, that even though I hadn't moved very far, I felt like I was in a fairly unfamiliar part of town. And so I started thinking about what home means in all sorts of different ways and contexts. And I in the end, decided to buy some homing pigeons and train them to home to their loft in East London. And by doing so, I hope to discover something about what home means for them and what home means for us, and lots of other questions in between.
And what sort of answers did you come up with?
Well, I don't know if I answered any questions or asked more of them, but I suppose I was struck by... So pigeons are obviously famous for their homing instinct, which is still this quite mysterious biological process that is fairly... it's contested, at least. And so the heart of the mystery is how they manage to find their ways home from places that they've never been to before, which they can do. And there was this the pull of home for pigeons is stronger than it is for many other creatures, and so there are all these kind of parallels between what motivates them to home and what motivates humans to home, and also what it means to make a home. At this period of my life, I just had my first child, and during the process of writing the book, I had a second child, and watching them explore their new territory and thinking about what it means to discover what home means for a child and for an adult all seem to be tied together in the image of the pigeon, because of course there are these parallels. You know, my 2-year-old and 5-year-old think of the area in which they live as the whole world, and gradually as they learn and grow up and learn to place that home in a larger context, first in terms of a city, then in terms of, you know, the world at large, the pigeons were doing exactly the same thing. First they were exploring the territory around the loft, around my house, and then gradually, as you train them to race, you take them further and further away from home and allow them to discover it. So in the end, I started thinking of the book as a kind of anti-travel book, as a book that was about staying in one place and thinking about what that felt like and what it meant.
Do you exercise them? Because I'm sure there's someone exercises them near me.
Yeah,
it's
a
huge circle which just gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
That will be a flyer, yeah. So I fly them every day, or twice a day actually. I fly them in the mornings, let them out of the loft, and they all go up, as you describe, quite high at first, go up for a couple of 100 metres or so, and then if the weather's nice, they go higher. Then they'll lap the loft in increasingly smaller circles, as you say, for about half an hour, an hour, and then I do the same in the afternoon. And that just keeps them fit and trim and, you know, lets them out and get a bit of fresh air. But I also train them to race by placing them in baskets and then taking them away from home and letting them fly home. And when they can beat me back, then you take them a slightly further distance, and gradually you get them used to the idea of flying from places they've never been to before. So some of my birds have flown back to London from Thurso, which is, you know, the northernmost town in Great Britain, which is about 504 miles from my home.
How did you go on in the Thurso race?
I'm gonna have to read the book to find out. Let's say I'm not a winner.
And they don't fly as the crow flies. They don't fly in a straight line.
They usually try and follow a straight line as far as possible, but lots of things affect their flight. So they don't fly very high, and they often follow, you know, they'll fly through the bottoms of valleys rather than over the high points, and they won't fly over mountains, and they won't fly over wooded valleys, wooded areas, because obviously hawks dwell there. So there's a lot of evidence that they use human infrastructure to navigate, especially when they're around their home lofts. So they like to follow straight lines, so they'll often follow canals or railway lines and so on. Another extraordinary thing I discovered is that when they're going on very long journeys, especially around Britain, which is obviously has a coastline very close to whatever route you're taking, they'll often fly to the coast and then fly about 50 metres out to sea over the ocean waves, so that if a peregrine or another bird of prey tries to strike them, the bird misses, it will go into the water, and so they know that this is a safer way. So they don't fly, they don't like to fly over water generally, but they often will if they're near a coastline, just fly slightly out to sea to give them that protection. So there's a logic to the routes they take, but it isn't always, as you say, the straightest or most direct route.
And there's an audio version, and you toyed with reading it yourself?
I did, yeah. I mean, like all writers, I think I like the sound of my own voice. You have to a little bit, but I was a bit concerned that I wouldn't be able to do the accents.
Now, it is available in audio, so that has opened up a whole new level of accessibility, so blind and print disabled people can read it as well. Is that important to you?
Yes, it is, yeah. I mean, I hadn't thought about it much, actually, until the audiobook was suggested by publishers, but of course it's something that is, I mean, as well as liking the sounds of their own voice, writers love readers, and the more readers that you can that can access your work is obviously something to be celebrated, both for you and for them. So I'm very thankful that there is an audio version of it. Yeah.
Those who had finished marking their birds stood to one side, smoking, discussing training strategies and breeding regimes, or moaning about the hawk attacks, which they said seemed to be becoming more frequent. As they waited, they checked the weather on their phones. Once all the pigeons had been marked, the baskets were fastened, the ties crimped with a small tin seal bearing a number and the image of a pigeon. Then the baskets were loaded onto a trailer while the flyers went inside the club to strike the clocks. Next, the birds were driven from the club to a service station on a motorway north of London, where they were loaded onto a larger lorry, along with pigeons from several other clubs. Thurso was an amalgamation race, which meant that birds from clubs across the south of England were racing against each other. The North London Federation, in which I was competing, was open to flyers who lived within a 33-mile radius of Wormwood Scrubs, but fanciers from Kent and Bristol had sent birds to Thurso too.
Matt Addis, reading from Homing by John Dee. Available commercially now. And finally on today's show. Also at the Wigtown Book Festival was Natalie Haynes, the star of BBC Radio 4's Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics, uniting history and comedy. She talked to Red Sail about the books of her life.
Natalie, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, The Dark is Rising by Susan Cooper, which isn't that well known in this country. I think it's better known in the US, but not for a good reason, because it's set here, it's written here. Susan Cooper, I think, lives in America, but is a British author. And it's the story of Will, who is the seventh son. And it's the second book in The Dark is Rising quintet. And it takes place over Christmas, and it is... I only have to think about it to feel Christmassy. And there are moments in it, like when the walker shouts bread and honey over and over again, or the attack of the crows, and that where I can't think of anything else. If I could do anything I wanted every December, I would read that. It's a beautiful piece of writing.
Too many, James shouted and slammed the door behind him. What? Said Will. Too many kids in this family, that's what, just too many. James stood fuming on the landing like a small, angry locomotive, and then stumped across to the window seat and stared out at the garden. Will put aside his book and pulled up his legs to make room. I could hear all the yelling, he said, chin on knees. More than anything, James said. Just stupid Barbara again, bossing. Pick this up, don't touch that. Mary joining in, twitter, twitter, twitter. I think this house was big enough, but there's always people. They both looked out of the window. The snow lay thin and apologetic over the world. That wide grey sweep was the lawn, with the straggling trees of the orchard still dark beyond. The white squares were the roofs of the garage, the old barn, the rabbit hutches, the chicken coops. Further back were the flat fields of Dawson's farm, dimly white-striped. All the broad sky was grey, full of more snow that refused to fall. There was no colour anywhere.
The Dark is Rising by Susan Cooper is available from RNIB as read by Gabriel Wolfe.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, so many, and I never get to because I always have to read for work. You know how this works. When you talk to writers, listen to books, read books, do any writing at all, you're always reading the next thing for work. The next thing is always the only thing, and you never get to reread anything. So I would really like to reread... I would really like to reread The Luminaries, which was my Booker winner, which I have read 4 times already, because I read it 3 times for the prize and I read it once to interview Eleanor Catton. So I should know it relatively well by now, but I would still happily go back and give it again.
Walter Moody, despite his reassuring countenance and despite the courteous detachment with which he held himself, was nevertheless still an intruder. The men were at a loss to know how to persuade him to leave without making it clear that he had intruded, and thus exposing the subversive nature of their assembly. Thomas Balfour had assumed the task of vetting him only by the accident of their proximity, next to the fire. A happy conjunction this, for Balfour was tenacious, for all his bluster and rhapsody, and well accustomed to turning a scene to his own gain.
"Yes, well," he said now, "one learns the customs soon enough, and everyone has to start where you were standing, as an apprentice, I mean, knowing nothing at all. What sowed the seed, then, if you don't object to my asking? That's a private interest of mine. What brings a fellow down here, you know, to the ends of the earth? What sparks a man?"
Eleanor Catton's The Luminaries, as with all the latest Booker shortlisted and winning titles, is available from RNIB in Braille, giant print and audio. The talking book is read by Mark Meadows and is TB20798.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Oh, I've been reading the Booker shortlist, so I can't choose one over the others because it makes me feel really guilty because I have to interview the authors in a few weeks. So I'm... advocating the entire Booker shortlist for now. Obviously wait until they're cheaper and in paperback or on audiobook. But Bernardine Evaristo's Girl, Woman, Other, Chigozie Obioma's Orchestra of Minorities, Salman Rushdie's Quixote, Margaret Atwood's Testaments, and Elif Shafak's 10 Minutes, 38 Seconds in This Strange World are all amazing books, so please read them.
All of the Booker shortlisted books are in... or are speedily on their way to the RNIB library. Thanks to Natalie Haynes and to Red Sail, and indeed everyone at the Wigtown Book Festival, Michelle Acton, Adrian Turpin, everyone behind the scenes, and everyone in the Writer's Retreat who kept us fed and watered.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But Read On will be back in the Wigtown Book Festival this time next year.
In the meantime, if you can't wait to get your weekly fix, don't forget we'll be back at the same time next Friday.
And if you can't wait that long, head to Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts and type in Read On RNIB Talking Books to find every single episode.
You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Red Sail, which is REDSZELL.
And I'm at Talking_Books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget
to read on.
You're listening to a Wigtown special book festival.
There!
Wigtown Festival book special. You're listening to a Wigtown Book Festival special edition of Read On.
Hey, I'll do.